Good morning, everyone. Maybe we better take our seats. We're running about 10 minutes late. I got a call from Mr. Herbert Armstrong, actually from Mrs. Armstrong this morning, and he had a rocky night. He didn't sleep too well, so he probably won't be here with us this morning. He may, but he'll be here this afternoon and told me to go ahead. So I've asked Mr. Luker to join me, and because he was supposed to speak a couple days ago also and didn't get to. And with that call and some other calls, and then I frankly got to thinking, boy, I got to prepare more quick. And I forgot where we were, just like some of you. And so my wife and I went to the wrong place and banged on the door, and I thought, oh my, what's happened? Everybody's gone to Petra, and I'm still here. Anyway, so that's what happened. But I see some others were wandering in out there, too, probably had the same difficulty. And we were locked out of the parking lot, too. So I sent my wife, I sent one of the ushers. I hope they'll let her know where we are, because she'll wander around and think, oh, there she is. Oh, wow, wonderful. They found her. Sitting with the Irish there. Mr. and Mrs. Hegwald are back from Ireland. Well, would you all rise, please, and we'll begin. Would you lead us again?
Father in heaven, we pause once again to remember who you are and to thank you very much that we have all been brought here safely. And Father, we do thank you for these facilities to meet in, considering the short notice that we had to make the change from Pasadena to here. Those who have worked very hard to arrange these facilities and the motels, we appreciate that. And thank you, Father, for the blessing of being here to strive once again under the leadership of Jesus Christ and your apostle to be together in unity. So please help us this morning, Father. Inspire Mr. Meredith. And please help me, Father, for it is our desire to be yielded to you, to be humble, to be servants, and to be able to back up your apostle and help him in this work as we all desire. So thank you, and we ask you to inspire this meeting and help us to yield our hearts to you. And we thank you in Christ's name. Amen.
Amen. Well, somehow it looks like even more people in this place, but I guess we can just see more of you because you're closer rather than sitting out in the dark, and we can see you a little bit better. So that's good, even though we're in a bigger arena, of course, and smaller proportionally. Anyway, I sure do appreciate the fellowship I've got to have with a number of you, and I'm sure all of you know that I can't come, and sometimes I go by and I start shaking hands on the way to eat or start shaking hands on the way to various places and wonder, then I have to stop. So if I hope we don't do that, why none of you feel in any way left out? There's 600 of us, and we are not able to have the personal fellowship and contact that I would like, of course. But I am grateful to have had the opportunity of being in so many parts of the world and the work, so I do know most of you, and sometimes I noticed last night I was saying, now you're, and then I'd get one of the names and they'd tell me the other because I had known them in time past, and appreciate that very much, and the loyalty and the encouragement so many of you have expressed. There have been a lot of letters and cards that have already come in, and Mr. LaRavia and others have mentioned that to me, that a lot of them are coming, and I'll be seeing them when I get back there, from the brethren, as well as the ministers and elders left behind, of encouragement to me and, of course, to Mr. Armstrong, and we're very grateful for that. I'd like to mention, just starting off this morning, now Mr. McMichael told me one good bit of news. I'd ask him to check as far as the business thing, and I'd also call Mr. LaRavia. I don't know from what direction it came, but I would say that he said that you are able to use your emergency fund, if you need to, for yourself, up to $50. We aren't able to pass out, but you can use the emergency fund checks up to $50 for any special need, you know, you have of just cash. So please go ahead and do that, and that'll be fine. And I think all of you know that we are going to have wartime Britain type of situation, probably for the next few months, in all honesty. It may not last months, it may just last weeks, but when Winston Churchill came into office, he says, you know, I have never promised you anything but blood, tears, sweat, and toil. And we're going to have a wartime situation. I don't want to make it sound too grim, but I think all of us came into this work being willing to sacrifice. I can say before God that I certainly did, and all of us early ministers in the work had to. Those of you who came along later, I might just say that. It wasn't that we were necessarily good, but we had to get that picture because there was not any other picture available at that time. we were not even getting our checks as students quite often for 3 to 6 weeks later, and they didn't all come at once then. They would drag them out, and we would literally have to go beg Vern Matson for a check so we could get our hair cut. Normally, we were cutting each other's hair, and that was back in the days when you had to have a haircut, by the way. Anyway, we had quite an interesting time. Lots of times we would have to eat in the Mayfair dining room pancakes, and then they would have those same pancakes that were left over the next day, and then the third day they didn't serve them for lunch or breakfast, but they would serve them for lunch with cheese in between or something, and used every bit of those pancakes up, and various other, you know, expediencies like that. We had a tremendous number of beans and soybeans, and we had quite an interesting time in those days. But at any rate, we did have to do our best to get by, and we did get by. I never felt persecuted during those days at all, or put down, because I knew that if I were really starving or something, I could have written my folks and they would have sent me money. They weren't wealthy, but they were, you know, lower middle class or whatever. But I didn't want to do that because they didn't want me to come out to Ambassador College anyway, and they weren't helping me one penny's worth, and never did help me one penny's worth and through college. And I was too proud to go beg them for something, so we were all in it together. And Dr. Hayes' mother would send us down some of her real thick type biscuits and what were they? Real thick rolls of some sort, and then some goat cheese and things like that. And we would pass that out, and then Mr. and Mrs. Elliott would make us, or she would make us a salad, because she knew us fellows would never make a salad sometimes when we were cooking for ourselves. And so we always managed to get by. And after graduation, and after being ordained as an evangelist, and then being an associate editor of the magazines and associate professor in Ambassador College, I was still only making $65 a week, which is less than I had been making between junior and senior year of high school, and between high school and junior college, and then the summer after the first year of Ambassador College. I'd made more money every one of those summers than I made for the first 2 or 3 years after being ordained, in spite of the fact we had a little bit of inflation even then, you know, and it wasn't worth as much. But I think I can honestly say for the first 3 to 5 years of my ministry, I was making less than I would have been making even in construction jobs, you know, as a high school or junior college kid. And for years after that, I was making less and had less, and the checks weren't there regularly, than I would have been making if I'd been in the world, and virtually all my friends that I grew up with were making. So we had to sacrifice and do without a lot of times. And I remember one time my wife and I had, this was years later, I couldn't have afforded this. This was 5 years after graduation. I bought a little home out in La Cañada. It was about 1,380 square feet, so it was very small. And my wife and I were not able to afford, you know, much furniture or curtains. We didn't even have drapes. We put up sheets, as many young couples do, on the windows. So we were trying to figure every way we could save. So we bought a hair clipper set, and she was going to cut my hair. Well, you know, Mr. Armstrong has always taught us quality and culture, and to try to, you know, look right. And he thought of us young ministers as young executives to help him build this big work. And these radio and TV people were coming around, and he was wanting to introduce us to them and to have us take trips with him occasionally and so on. But anyway, the very first time I went up to see Mr. Armstrong after this haircut, which wasn't too bad, I didn't think at all. But anyway, we had a long talk about things in the work, and then right at the end, he looked at me kind of fatherly or something, and he said, "Well, Rod," he says, can I mention something personal to you?" And I said, "Well, sure." He said, "Who's been cutting your hair lately?" And so I told him, and he says, "Well," he said, "now you're getting a salary, you know, and so you can afford to have your hair cut," and so on and so forth. So I said, "Yes, sir," and I did. But anyhow, that's the way we were for so many of those years. But we may have to go back to a little bit of that for a while, for the next few months, because of the present thing. This receiver has taken so much money, and this whole thing is bound to have hurt us a little bit, as I think you know. And I don't mean, you know, forever, but it certainly has done damage. There's no question about it. So I hope we will all tighten our belts, and we will think of ourselves in that way, as the brethren, or our Israelitish brethren in wartime Britain, where Churchill promised them blood, tears, toil, and sweat, and they worked hard, and they saved the ship, and we did make it. Well, now, yesterday, as probably many of you heard, they had a great day out at headquarters. They had almost 5,000 people there on the campus, almost 5,000. Did I tell you that yesterday afternoon? And they had about 250 sheriff's deputies finally come to get the judge in the building. But we had them locked out, and they decided that they would retreat. They didn't try to break in, and so that was good. I think it was Wayne Pyle, this red-headed fellow that works there, very dedicated, and the one was telling me about it last night. I forget who this was. And Mr. LaRavia called this morning, and one of the deputies or someone said, "But we're coming in." And he says, "Well, you're not coming in unless you break the door down." So they went back and conferred a while, and then they just went on. Because I say it's a civil thing, and many of the policemen were themselves very sympathetic, and many of the sheriffs very sympathetic to us, because they realize as the word is getting out, I maybe should have brought the newspapers, but the news coverage is much more favorable. And on television, some of you have seen it, and you know they talk about the picnic-like atmosphere of people and old ladies and young women with their babies and reading Bibles, and it seemed more like a church picnic, and very kindly people and happy and this and that. So the sheriff's deputies, they know that, and they know it's a civil thing, and they're really very reluctant to do anything. And so they backed down and went away, and then finally they worked out a compromise with the judge and the receiver, you know, I should say, yesterday about noon, I guess, or early afternoon. And so finally the judge came back, that is the receiver, the ex-judge, excuse me, and Mr. Rader himself let him in the building, I guess, to get his things, because the receiver has now agreed to move down to the press building and accounting area and not even be in the Hall of Administration. So we're very glad about that. There are not going to be even any guards around the Hall of Administration or the House of God or anything. They're backing down. And the next step, of course, is no receivership at all, as I think you know. And they're beginning to realize that they are in the wrong, and they have far exceeded their bounds. But we're not going to let them off with a slap on the wrist, I can tell you that. But we should be able to operate much more as usual, and there is no sit-in planned for today or tomorrow, as long as they keep their part of the agreement. And I might say this, and I don't want to say too much because it's a matter of us working it out the right way, but there are certain highly placed people, very highly placed, higher than the California government, that are very concerned. And some of these people in California may themselves be held in criminal contempt because of their actions. And it's going the other way. And we may be vindicated more powerfully than many of us realize. So we're very grateful for that, and that God is fighting this battle for us. And I'm very grateful for these things. I might also mention to you, brethren, a couple of things that, not to go back and rehash things, but some of the ministers themselves have mentioned this to me, that a lot of you, because frankly, they just keep on being certain dissidents, even among us, that are not loyal at all. And if those of the rest of you hear that, you can realize they're still just feeding out crazy things and wild things in many cases, or just plain sort of negative things, just a constant negativism. And if that negativism engulfs you, bitterness can destroy you, a root of bitterness. And say, "Well, they're doing this and they're doing that, and we can't believe anything." Well, I guess if it comes to the fact that you can't believe God's apostle, and you can't believe those who are doing the work of God and will continue to do the work of God, I guess it's true that you can't, if two cannot walk together, you know, they cannot walk together unless they be agreed. But we want to give you every opportunity, at least, reasonably, to believe what we say and to know that we are not playing games at all. And but I just want to mention that as some of the fellows have brought this to me, I'm not trying to grind an axe on it one way or the other. And I've told you about that. But let's remember, brethren, the judge title himself and his assistants, of course, have already examined the major charges about Rader, Cornwall, and Kessler, and those are already out in the open, and as far as it's indicated that there have been no charges, no criminal charges, that's already exonerated. I talked to Jack Kessler myself, about 3 to 5 months ago, had a long lunch with him. He's been a friend of mine, and he used to work for us in CAD, as it was then. As many of you know, Jack was one of the CAD people, right along with Glenn Nice and John Anderson and several that are still there. And he was our business, agent, let's say, and the go-between between us and the business office to keep the records for church administration. And he was working on his accountancy degree, and of course now he has his CPA and his law degree. But Jack told me months ago, in this luncheon I had with him, because I questioned him on it just as a matter of general curiosity. I said, well, people are saying that, here you're doing the bookkeeping for us or the outside auditing, and yet Rader and Cornwall are still with your firm and they're with us. And how can this be? And he said, well, really, it's true. He says, they have nothing to do with our firm anymore. And I said, well, how come you keep their name? Well, he said, that's something that's standard practice all through the legal and accounting professions. You buy a name. You know, like when someone buys out, if they do, Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Finner & Smith, you know, the biggest stock brokerage firm on earth. You think they're suddenly going to change the name to Jones Brothers? It would cost them literally millions of dollars. They're going to keep that corporate name. That is the name you purchase. And he said that he had bought out Stan Rader, I think back in 1972 was the year. Now, I may not have the dates exactly right, but it was way back when, in 1972 or 3, along in there. And that Mr. Rader has no financial interest. He has no control. Mr. Kessler does not ask him the time of day at all. And he didn't say it in that way, but I'm just telling you that, in other words, they're still friends in that sense and associates as far as occasionally contacting one another. But he says months will go by. In fact, he told me right then it would have been a few months since he'd even seen Mr. Rader in person. He doesn't talk to him on the phone. Mr. Rader has no control at all. I said, well, what about Mr. Cornwall? Well, he bought him out, I think it was 1975, if I'm not mistaken. And he has no interest in the firm either. So really, it's Kessler and Palazzo, another young lawyer, an accountant, because Mr. Palazzo had a brilliant background in foreign, law or accounting, and could get him some of the Arab accounts and others that were coming into Beverly Hills. And so Mr. Kessler is fixed completely on his own, and he has no connection with them. Well, the judge already knows that. And they have already approved the sale of properties. They found nothing. They've looked into those things. That's the first thing they looked into. They're not lodging any charges about the sale of properties. We had appraisals on those properties around the campus. One of the major properties was one just north of Green Street and just west of Orange Grove that we sold, because that had been bought with the idea we would buy this Arroyo Vista Hotel, you see, and then that would be kind of a parking lot or something connected with that if they expanded the college into a great big mini university that some were talking about, which would have been a horrifying financial drain on the work, as you know, because even the college last year was up to $17 million as far as the total expenditures, and yet we know that included some things that were put under the college that could have been put somewhere else. I realize that too. Nevertheless, it was getting to be a huge expense proportionally in the work of God. And so they did sell that property. There was no more need to it for it. And property values are high. And if there is a coming recession, which most people think there is coming, we might not get more, we might get less in another year than we would now. And probably it has been a good thing we've sold those properties, because we don't need them. And a few of the faculty homes, as you know, were sold, and which is good too. And the Big Sandy sale, as you know, was approved by the court. Maybe you didn't know that. Go back and read the newspapers. There's nothing mysterious about that. We had an appraisal, and the appraisal, as Mr. Rader said, was what, $6 or $6.5 million. That was the appraisal, and we sold it for $10.6 million. Now, for those of you who have not been to Big Sandy, you might think, oh my, all these acres and so on. Well, of course, if you put all those acres in Pasadena, in an expensive area, that'd be worth a fabulous amount of money. But those acres are in East Texas, kind of swampland, and they're not in a place that brings a lot of money. And I'm not against East Texas. I don't want to turn some of you off who are from Texas. I love to go there and to visit the campus, and there was a warmth and an esprit de corps that I loved, and I enjoyed it. And I'm very sorry that we had to sell Big Sandy. But I want to tell you this, you Texans, I lived through the same thing over in Brickett Wood. I'd been put down and down and down, and finally from chancellor or coordinating chancellor of the three colleges was made the deputy chancellor of the smallest of the three, and not even completely in charge even then, because I was kind of halfway under Mr. Hunting, as those who were there knew and sensed obviously at that time, and did not have freedom of movement at all, and I knew that. But then they sold even that campus right out from under us, so to speak, in spite of the fact that Robert Kuhn himself and that Ron Dart himself, in the presence, frankly, of Dr. Ward, I believe, and also certainly Mr. Ron Kelly, who's here, were at dinner at Ron Dart's home about four or five months before that was sold, Brickett Wood, that is, and where the campus was closed at least. And they all told me, Robert Kuhn and Frank Brown, I think, told me once the same thing, and others of Ted's advisors, four or five of them, that every one of them advised that the campus at Big Sandy be sold and that the one at Brickett Wood be retained, because Brickett Wood was much less expensive to operate and it had a unique value to the work as far as training our overseas ministers, printing the plain truth, you know, and all those things, and mailing the plain truth, which they're still doing over there, incidentally, because it is cheaper, college or no. But anyway, because of the particular individual involved who wanted to make it a personal thing, they went the other way. Where, in fact, by the logic of everyone concerned, even by the deputy chancellor at that time, Ron Dart, and I sat right in his living room at dinner on the deputy chancellor exchange trip that I was on in February 1974, just about 4 months before Brickett Wood was closed, and he told me he knew that something like that might have to happen, but he was going to strongly urge that his own college be closed and that Brickett Wood be kept open because it had a greater need in the work. But those of us from Brickett Wood did not get all bitter and go around and spread all kinds of malicious rumors because we lost our jobs and because we had to change and we had to do this and that. And some of the Brickett Wood people had to go all the way back home to Australia, New Zealand, thousands of miles away, and leave that wonderful atmosphere and family warmth and unity that we did have at Brickett Wood. But they did remain loyal, all but a very few. In fact, none of them turned disloyal until after Mr. Hunting and Plachet later rebelled, about a year and a half later. None of them immediately turned sour and went off. So let's all understand, we've all had to go through things, and let's take them in good spirit and realize maybe it's been God's will that we cut back to one campus, and if He ever wants us to get back up to two or three again, well, that's great, and I'm all for that. I love that idea of having the different campuses, but we can't afford it right now, and maybe God knew this very thing was coming. He knows things we don't know. And maybe He knew this very kind of thing was coming and how difficult it would have been to keep, you know, Big Sandy plus Pasadena with all the recent things that we've had. Anyway, let's realize that these things, including the sale of Mr. Rader's home and all, are all been looked into already. And there have been no criminal charges filed. It was all known, absolutely, every bit of it, by Mr. Armstrong. It's all been a matter of public record. All the major things that have been charged so far have already been laid out. They've already fired their big cannons. And as I said the other day, I personally have talked to two former business managers and three or four top assistants in the business area who were working on projects to try to uncover something from within, and had an outside, in one case, I think an outside auditor or bookkeepers come in to help them. And they still didn't find one thing, even though they were trying to from the inside under Ted Armstrong to try to get something on Stan Rader. And there wasn't one thing. It was just that Mr. Armstrong felt that he should let him continue in a certain standard of living that he'd had before, and not to put him down just the minute he was baptized. And that's been Mr. Armstrong's subjective judgment that he ought to do that. And so you'll have to criticize him for that. But I think in criticizing him for that type of thing, which is not illegal, you end up criticizing God. Well, I didn't want to mention that one factor. Now, I want to point out the other part, though, and that is that Jesus Christ may be orchestrating all of this more than we realize, and He certainly can and does cause all things to work together for good for those of us who love Him and are called according to His purpose. And if we love Him, we'll keep His commandments and we'll honor the offices He set and we'll be faithful to His work. But God can cause this to turn out because we're already beginning to have tremendous nationwide media exposure. And the name Worldwide Church of God is going to be a household name. And, you know, all kinds of advertisers just trying hard to just get that name brand in people's minds. And that's already being done. And with the vindication, which we do confidently expect, the vindication, then there will be a tremendous impetus in the minds of many to say, oh, you're the people that kind of got persecuted. Well, we want to know who you are now. And you turned out to be right after all. And this is going to help our broadcasting, our telecasting, our plain truth circulation, our newsstand program, and frankly, it's going to open up big opportunities in the future. I don't say tomorrow, but I say in 6 months to a year from now, probably big opportunities for many of us working with our local church growth in newsstands, which can become a very big thing. And I've talked to some of you about that, how some of the men have used the newsstands in a particular manner and has really begun to bring in a tremendous number of new people into their churches and been even far more effective in many, many church areas than the broadcast of the last 5 or 7 years, because the broadcast was not what it ought to have been at all. And as you know, John Lundberg and others had to write up this great written report and finally give it to Mr. Armstrong, showing that it was almost impossible to get Ted to even come into the TV studio and do anything. He wouldn't do anything, and it only made one or two in 1 year, and Mr. Armstrong made more new programs in a few weeks than he'd been making in about a year, and they couldn't get him to do that. because of all the other things that I think you realize, the playboyism and everything else that have been so absolutely rampant over the last several years in God's work. And so the Plain Truth Newsstand program can become a big thing. And also it's going to open up big opportunities, I think, for us to go out once the Newsstand program gets going and other media exposure to have evangelistic campaigns across this country. And they're going to know who, oh, you're those people, and we're going to advertise. And also probably many local Bible studies or Bible lectures, you know, public Bible lectures in other areas where we have an area where we don't want to send in a kind of a man experience with campaigns. Many of your local ministers may, if we capitalize on this properly, be able to have public Bible lectures if you and we do not feel it ought to be called a campaign and begin to reap a harvest. So we certainly hope that, and I think it's going to open up a lot of opportunities. Also, a lot of opportunities are going to open up for all of you as we begin to have growth in the work, and because of the shakeup, some have already left. Others are going to leave, I know that, of the disloyal men, and those of you who are loyal are simply going to have more opportunities to serve than you ever did. More fluidity up and down, you know, to have a chance to do more and to serve more and to have more opportunity. And I want to also say something that I talked over with the area coordinators, and I did have two long meetings with them, well, actually three altogether, meetings with the area U.S. area coordinators, plus two with the overseas men, and the overseas coordinators basically were with the U.S. coordinators too for the second round of meetings. But at any rate, they all agreed. I didn't hear any nays, and they all seemed to be very enthusiastic about the idea that I had of giving more opportunity and responsibility to the senior pastors. Because the senior pastors, as you know, the senior pastorate idea was created as kind of a token thing. Frankly, Ted was so scared of delegating authority at all after the regional directors were, you know, hollering for his resignation in 1974. Why, he was afraid to let them have any authority from then on. He was afraid to let the senior pastors have any authority. And many of the senior pastors have told me, throughout the country, that they just had a kind of a token post. There was really no responsibility. In other words, they were just a big brother. If anyone wanted to come and ask them a question, he could. But if anyone didn't want to come, they were just like anyone else. Well, we do propose to change that, and I don't mean tomorrow. We're going to give it more study, but we definitely will change it. I'll say that. We definitely will change it. And we're going to give more opportunity, and with Mr. Armstrong's permission, we may even change the title of the area coordinators. I don't want to change all titles around again, but I think in this case it might be good. Keep the area coordinators the way they are, 12 of them. And I think that's good. I think that post and that number is just fine. But then we will also have the senior pastors probably called district superintendents, as they were in the past. And each area coordinator then, as we have growth, would be able to have 3 to 5 or 6 district superintendents under him. And those district superintendents would be able to work with the men under their charge to bring new men along, to encourage them, to teach them how to build a church and work with them and to give them advice. And not just in case they were asked, but that would be the responsibility. And to go hear them preach, and then to have them come to their church and preach as we used to do, and each one encouraging and teaching and working with the others in his district to make the newer men and younger men be able to come along. And that would give more opportunity for everyone, and because, as I say, of the crisis, we're going to have a lot more fluidity in that particular way. And I think it's going to give opportunity for a lot more people to serve and a lot more cohesiveness and growth in the ministry. And I want to ask you at this point to please send in your ideas to me. If any of you want to send up notes here, it's fine. Or when you get back home, you may not want to here. But I definitely do want your ideas for growth and for better ways to structure and handle the field ministry here and around the world. And I promise you, we will read your ideas, that I will read them personally. I won't have someone else read them. Mr. Luker will also read them, and he'll probably read every single word, and I will probably read every single word. And we will read them personally, and we may even have others, such as Mr. Raymond McNair and others, be able to read every word of your ideas, and our headquarters team can get together and use your ideas, because this is going to give us an opportunity to make improvements, and we do want to do that. And I'd like to say here, some are asking, well, couldn't we take all kinds of general questions and this and that at this time? And I really feel, and I've talked to Mr. Armstrong about this, that this is not the time to do that, although you're certainly free to send up questions or give me written questions if you want to during the noon period, and we'll try to maybe cover some of those this afternoon. But we're not going to go off on this and that another tangent, because some of your questions could be actually inspired by this wave of negativism and simply create more of that. I'm just being open with you on it, and I don't think we need any more of that. Also, some of your questions may be unable to be answered because we're in a process of evolution, in a sense, because of this crisis, and there are a lot of things that we just don't know the answers to just yet. And we may know the answers within days or weeks after we get back to Pasadena, but I hate to shoot from the hip and try to answer things just off the top of my head that I really don't know about just yet. But if any of you want to turn in questions or ideas for future growth during the noon period, you certainly may. And then I encourage you heartily in the future, that is over the next several weeks, to send us in ideas you may have about restructuring or modifications in the field ministry, any aspect thereof that you wish to send in. And we will certainly try to listen, and we will try to learn, and we will try to do the very, very best that we can, and I'm sure with God's help that we will. And I am not afraid of delegation. I know just at the time that I began to do that the very most in my administration, it was back in the spring of 1973, Mr. Portoon had got Dr. James Stark, who is a nationally known management consultant, to give the evangelists a 15-week working seminar on management. And I'd studied a few books on management before that, but only two or three. I think this book for executives only, you know, this big thick one with chapters by different ones, and perhaps one or two other books I'd read either all or major parts of, but I hadn't really had a course in management. So Dr. Stark was to give us a 15-week course, 3 hours each week, and we had to read, frankly, about 2 hours outside for every hour inside. There was a lot of heavy reading, which I know was very difficult for me at that time because I was running the whole field ministry and problems were already occurring, and Ted had been put out for 4 months because of his situations and was banished, and things were kind of uptight even then. Still, I tried to do that reading, and of course, when Ted came back, that course got chopped off after about 10 weeks because he was upset and afraid. I don't know what he was afraid of, but that we would learn too much or something. But at any rate, we did have 10 weeks or 30 hours under Dr. Stark, and then he did, even at the last session, give us further things to read that would have helped fill out the period that he would have done. And I certainly did go ahead and read management for either scores or hundreds of hours after that, and we'll continue to do so. And so I'm not afraid of delegating, and I want to get loyal men that we can rely upon, but then you delegate, you give them an opportunity, and of course you give them, as you all know, you give them responsibility, and you give them accountability, and it's a very, very important thing to be able to run an organization properly. Now, I want to describe at this point our headquarters team, because I haven't really done this. This has already been approved by Mr. Herbert Armstrong, and most of you probably already know about it, but many may not. And the headquarters pastoral administration team at this time, and I'll say at this time because it may be added to later, I don't want to have a little tiny nucleus of people and get ourselves off in a corner. I want a broad spectrum of ideas, and I want you to be able to send in things freely. And, of course, if you are railing and cursing at us or something, well, that doesn't make us happy. But you know what I mean. There are people in horrible negative attitudes. Even now, they're saying, we can't believe this, and we can't do this, and they just go on and on. And I guess I could stand on my head up here and as they say, stack BBs, and they still wouldn't be convinced. So all I can say is that we're going to do our best before God, and you'll have to know by the fruits. And all of you who've been in the ministry very long, you can know by the fruits of what went before, too. I just want to say that. I have been, in the past, too strict, and I have a somewhat serious personality, been a little austere, and so on, and I know that. And I prayed to God hundreds of times to help me modify that. I think age and experience and suffering has already helped me do that a great deal, and I intend with God's help to do that even more. But I know even David Antion, and I'll quote his name here in the right way, even though he went out in 1974, as you know, and was permitted back in, and now has gone out again in this rebellion and this collusion. Nevertheless, Mr. Antion told me, I tell you this before God, and I'm quoting him almost exactly. This was in 1974 when he'd been in office there a couple of years already. And he said, no, this was in, not in 1974, I believe it was in 1973. Anyway, it was after he'd been back in for some time. And, or not back in, but in my office, my former office over the churches. But he said, Rod, he said, the real problem back there was not you personally. He said, I've been very close to the field ministers, and he said, I know that you could probably count on the fingers of one hand those that you've offended personally. He said the problem was the system, that we had to get in, you know, 18 to 21 visits a week and send in reports, and we had to fill out this and fill out that. Well, then, as you know, we reduced it to 15 to 17 and then to 10 to 12 suggested. But by that time, it was too late, and the momentum had been built up. And then if the spokesman clubs ran more than 10 minutes over, why, some of my best friends even, you know, Mr. Dean Blackwell and others, who loves people but likes to talk, you know, and so on, why, we'd send him, you know, he would get snowflakes from heaven, as they were called, under Robert McNamara's administration when he was the whiz kid Secretary of Defense. They called them snowflakes from heaven. He'd send out memos, and he kept 18 secretaries busy, and he was doing this and that. And so I thought, well, I'll do that too, I guess. And I had Dan Porter, who loved to do that. And so we would send out memos saying, your spokesman club went 15 minutes over. Will you please explain why? And this guy'd get this memo, and then he'd just gnash his teeth, and he'd say, they're against me, and oh, they're going to get me. And I think a lot of you, or the men at that time, took it personally and thought we hated them, and oh, you know, Mr. Meredith doesn't love me anymore because he's correcting me. And I didn't feel that. It was just a routine thing. We'd send these out. Well, we're not going to bug you about those little things anymore if we can possibly help it. And we're going to try to learn, and we're going to try to grow, but in every way we can. But on the positive side, I think all of you know that during the 11 years, which is more time than Dave Anion, Wayne Cole, and Ron Dart, all three had, including both of Wayne's administrations, I was more in that office more than all three of them put together, by far. In fact, about double that time. And so during that time, we did have unity. We did have consistency. We did have stability. We did have loyalty to Mr. Armstrong that was constantly taught. And there weren't any little games of that sort being played during that time at all for 11 solid years. And I pray that it will be the same again or up until Christ comes, if that's His will. And if it's His will that I be queen for a day, as I've kidded about, and that I be kicked out if I can't really serve you and do the job, I pray that that takes place, because I've been up and I've been down, and I'm up again, and I can go back down, and I've gone up and down on the elevator several times now, and I'm used to it, and I can take it again, and I will. But I hope you'll be able to rightly have loyalty to Mr. Armstrong and those whom he appoints, and look a little bit at the fruits. Because we didn't have all kinds of politics and backstabbings and people stabbed. I think the one that I corrected, I wish he were here so I could get him up and have him talk to you. But he did mention some things in a warm way when I did that out there in one of the meetings. Mr. Dean Blackwell was the one that I corrected personally more than I think all the rest put together when I was superintendent. And that was because Dean is one of the most loving, friendly people, and loves to talk to people, loves to involve himself with the brethren, but he did it so much that he was actually losing sleep, breaking his health, and one time, with Mr. Armstrong's permission, after he had a heart attack, I had to command him, and I said, I command you, Dean, for me and Mr. Armstrong to spend 8 hours in bed, whether you're asleep or not, and just lie there and quiver, see? That's what I told him, and we want you to get over your heart attack. And sometimes, of course, I had to command him to quit keeping the spokesman club until 10 or 11 o'clock, and then having Mr. Tkach and Mr. Filippello and Mr. Fowler and Mr. Cormany and Mr. Foster and Mr. whoever the rest of you guys were, I think part of the time Mr. McMichael and Mr. Meeker and the others who can all testify. You know, he just loved people. He'd keep them up till midnight or 2 o'clock more often. And some of these guys had a job the next day. You know, and they couldn't get in their study, and they couldn't get in their prayer, and I had to constantly work with Dean on some of those little human problems. But I love the guy, well, Mr. McCready, too. And Mr. McCready still loves Dean, don't you? Very much. But how many times were you sort of actually pressured to stay up after midnight just because of the situation? Midnight was early, he said. I've got a witnesses here, heard him get a shot. Midnight was early. So we had those things, you know, but anyway, that was the Dachau of that day. But we did have unity, and we did have loyalty to Mr. Armstrong, and we didn't have any plots or things of that sort. So hope that those of you who were not there can get the picture in the right way. And there were some mistakes, and we'll try to correct those. But basically, we did have growth, and God blessed us during those years, and we did have unity. Well, anyway, the headquarters team that we now have, beside myself as director, is Mr. Luker here sitting with me, who is the assistant director of the ministry worldwide. And he is not the assistant to the director. He is the assistant director with line authority. And I'm giving him specific responsibilities, of course. He will be the main one to interface with the ministerial services department about all your questions and problems regarding hall rentals and ministerial fleet program and salaries and everything else. He'll be the main one to interface with Ted Herlofson and the ministerial services, and with, as it now is, Rod Matthews and the as overseas coordinator and those areas. Another one of his responsibilities, I should have brought back the card that I have on my desk in Pasadena, but anyway, another one of his responsibilities will be the ideas, and to give me, as the top level advisor, ideas for upgrading and improvement and growth in the ministry and in the field churches. And he's certainly going to be doing that and working with me on all the major plans. A third part of his responsibility will be to, of course, make field visits at the holy days and all other times, and to conduct area conferences and overseas area conferences. And I believe there was one more, a fourth one, but I can't remember what it was. But we'll be adding more. But I can just say to you now that Mr. Luker has been close to me, and I won't apologize for that. And so anything that you want to ask him, just ask him. It doesn't make any difference to me. Because if he stabs me in the back and my wife stabs me in the back, I'll just go on and slash my wrists, I guess. But, you know, somewhere along the line you have to trust people, so I just trust them as much as we trust anyone. And God says he that trusts in his own heart is a fool, so we can't trust ourselves perfectly. And even us, those of us who are upset, I hope we can realize that. If we trust in our own heart, we're a fool. We have to realize, well, Christ is in charge. And we still have the church of God and all these sheep out here, and Christ has given them to us, and are we going to be faithful to them and faithful to the headquarters to keep them together? Do we want to just spread negativism and so on and hurt those poor sheep out there? This is a responsibility we have. But anyway, for those of you who do not know, Mr. Luker graduated from the University of Delaware and was one of the senior officers in the college ROTC, the rank of captain or major, whatever it was. And he was also co-captain, I think, of the football team and halfback at the University of Delaware. Then he worked for a couple of years at Bendix, I believe it was.
North American Aviation
out in Los Angeles as an engineer. And then he came to Ambassador College and took 3 years to graduate, as I did myself and others of us, and was there 3 solid years, was senior class president in the class of 1963. So he graduated 15 and a half years ago after having degrees from the University of Delaware and Ambassador College and having been out in business for a couple of years, you might say, as an engineer. And then he went to the field and for 6 or 6.5 years was up in the Bay Area, Sacramento, and then over in Oakland and all through that area as a minister, and then later a district superintendent for 4 or 5 years, and then was back for 6 months to a year in the Minneapolis area as a district superintendent, because I'd already secretly made up my mind to have him come in and help me, but I wanted to have him get experience, which I guess was hard on him and Leanne, but I literally wanted them to get, well, I thought it would be a year back there, but we had to speed it up because of problems and needs, but I thought they would get the experience of living in the cold country, and some of you, you know, he could have empathy with you, and the ice and the snow tires and all the other things you have to go through. So we did that, and then he came in and was helping me about three and a half years as assistant to the superintendent at that time at headquarters in Pasadena, helping over the whole U.S. field ministry at that time and having already had that experience. Then because of his faithfulness and his loyalty, which was well known by all who worked with him and has never been questioned by anyone so far as I know, and saying everything they could, and he had opportunity to do that over and over and over, and he never did it. Well, I appreciate loyalty, needless to say. But anyway, Mr. Dart picked him up and sent him as the director of the entire work of God, the ministry, everything in Australia. And so he was over the work in Australia for 4.5 years in the entire continent down there, and increased the number of churches down there from about 20 to 35 or 38. What are the numbers? I don't know.
12 to 36.
Anyway, he'll let him explain more about it. But anyway, I know it grew a great deal, and I knew that down there, when I got to visit Australia 2.5 years ago at the Feast of Tabernacles 76, I had a universal outpouring. And I do mean this, brethren, and a lot of you Aussies are here to testify to that fact. all the deans and all the rest of them. But anyway, I had Mark Cardona sitting there. I had a universal outpouring of respect and affection that came to me toward Mr. Luker. And they said, oh, what a wonderful man. And we've never had the warmth and the closeness and all of this that they did, you know, until Mr. Luker got there. And they appreciated him very, very much. The vast majority of them, and well, all of them. I didn't see any dissenting voice, and I didn't go up and say, well, now I'm Mr. Luker's friend, and what do you say? I made it a point not to do that, but in spite of them being, you know, perhaps not knowing that, they still said those things, and brethren, by the scores, were telling me that. And Mr. Dart and Mr. McCullough and others told me the same thing. So I do want you to know he's had experience worldwide, living overseas for 4.5 years, plus helping out in the ministry here in the States for a great number of years, and now back recently for about 1.5 years as a senior pastor in Phoenix, increasing that church, almost doubling the size of it, and adding 2 new churches, at least with the 2 new churches in Prescott. And now my mind goes blank. I was saying it the other day. What's the other place?
Prescott and Flagstaff.
Flagstaff, adding a couple churches nearby in his area. And we've had constant growth over there, more than we did before he came. And they, again, all the brethren have told me that I've talked to in Phoenix. So I appreciate that, and for that reason, and because I am glad to delegate, I can't do it all. Like the Volkswagen, I too am human, you know, and very human, and I know that. And I do not have the ability of Mr. Armstrong. I do not have the ability of a lot of men, and I'm deeply conscious of that, brethren, and I need your help and your prayers. But I do want to delegate, and with the help of Jesus Christ, we will do a job. I guarantee you that. So Mr. Luker is going to help me in that office and will be, of course, the most direct help as the assistant director, not assistant to, but assistant director of the ministry worldwide. Next, Mr. Raymond McNair, not next in rank, but just in his direct input, because Mr. McNair remains as deputy chancellor of Ambassador College, and also as the top ministerial and theological advisor, in a sense, at least one of the top advisors, and certainly the top one as a personal advisor to Mr. Armstrong in theological and doctrinal matters and other matters. But Mr. Raymond McNair is going to also be a member of our team, by my wishes, not by Mr. Armstrong. He never told me I ought to get Mr. McNair. But Mr. McNair was criticized for being Mr. Armstrong's spy. So I want Mr. McNair, to spy on me day and night, and Mr. Luker, I hope, will spy on me day and night, and I hope all the rest of you will. I'm glad to have everybody spy on me. I really am. The more spies, the better, just so you'll give me your ideas and help me at least have an opportunity to take your ideas if you think I'm making a mistake. Anytime there is a plot or collusion of disloyalty that is off and running, though, you go right to Mr. Armstrong, and you don't need to come to me first in that case. That's what we've had to do, and that's what you ought to do with me. If you think I'm making a mistake and I just don't understand and you want to give me help and input, you should come to me first, of course. But if I get a plot going against Mr. Armstrong or against God's work, then you go right up over me quick and stop that plot, because that then becomes not a matter of a personal sin against another brother. That is a crime of treason against the Republic. And if you catch a group of traitors about to blow up the Capitol, or about to blow up the White House, and they've got the dynamite set and the fuse is already going, you don't come to them quietly and say, well, now, brother, I want to sit down and chat with you, brother to brother, to see if your attitude is okay. You better go quick to the Capitol Police and get them to bring their demolition squad before it's too late, and unplug the charges of dynamite. So that's the way I intend to operate, and I always have, but intend to more than ever. So Mr. McNair, I don't want to kid about him being a spy, because, you know, I've been very close to him, but I'm just saying that openly, lest there's any question about it in anyone's mind. Mr. McNair and Mr. Burke McNair, whom I'll mention later, I don't know what they are. Some of you say, oh, there he goes, brother-in-law, great family plot. All right, let's answer that charge right now. First of all, is he my brother-in-law? I don't know. I've been so busy the last several weeks since this appointment, I haven't had a chance to study it. My wife has 2 brothers, and they are my brothers-in-law now. Now, he is either my ex-brother-in-law, which I think is correct, or maybe he still is my brother-in-law, but he is my brother in God's church, as you all are my brothers in God's church. And he is one of the 3 pioneer evangelists in this work of God who still remains faithful, because Marion, his older brother, left, and Raymond Cole left, and my uncle, Dr. Meredith, died faithfully in God's service about 11 years ago. And Mr. Dick Armstrong died faithfully, almost as a martyr in God's service, 21 years ago, back in 1958, on a baptizing tour, actually in the direct work of God and doing it as he died. And so the three of us remain, Dr. Hay and Mr. McNair and I, and he's one of those, and has had vast experience throughout the U.S. ministry for years and years before he went overseas, and more recently for a year or two back in Lake of the Ozarks, and now back here again, plus 15 solid years building the whole work of God in Britain and spending the majority of his adult life overseas, in Britain and Europe for a while too, traveling constantly to the continent, and very well aware, as you overseas men know, of the work in Belgium and France and Luxembourg and Germany and Switzerland and so on. So certainly he will be a top advisor and help on our team. Then another man on the headquarters, and you can feel free to contact him about anything also if you can't get to Mr. Luker or me. And then another top man on our team will be Mr. Gerald Waterhouse. And I intend to bring in Mr. Waterhouse. And Gerald, I think I mentioned this to you, but if you're, are you here? I'm sure he's here somewhere, but I don't see him. Where is he? Okay. Anyway, I hope you'll come up during the noon hour if you would. And I do want to talk to you briefly, if you would, Gerald, about this. But I think I talked to him. But we've just been going every my whole job during this last 3.5 weeks has been putting out brush fires. You realize that? And we haven't had a chance just for a normal long list of this and that and planning. It's just been calling morning until night. And if I seem a little tired or sound a little tired or something at times, I hope you'll understand that. I have not had such a hectic 3.5 week period since the day I was born. And I really mean that. And I'm grateful that my health has stood up under it. But anyway, I do want Mr. Waterhouse to operate out from headquarters. And of course, he may go out on extended tours overseas as well as throughout the U.S. and Canada like he did before, plus make specific field visits to help out and all types of things like that, which is his strength and a tremendous strength and help to the local churches. And we will continue to persecute Gerald if he goes 3 to 5 hours. He knows that, so he'll get me for that later. But anyway, he's cut his time back to about 2 hours. You notice I said about. But he is a tremendous help and inspiration to me when I hear him personally. I really mean that, about the organization of God's government and the world tomorrow and other things that he's been able to bring in such an effective manner. So I want him on our team. And then backing us up and helping us will be Mr. Will Berg. Most of you know Mr. Will Berg. Well, I didn't explain. Oh, I know another top man, excuse me, that I left out, just skipping over without thinking, was Mr. Bert McNair, who was also ordained yesterday as an evangelist. And Mr. Bert McNair, as you know, is one of the half dozen senior men in the field ministry on earth. I said on earth. So again, you say, oh, brother-in-law or ex-brother-in-law. Well, how many of you have an ex-brother-in-law, as he is, probably, who was one of the half dozen senior men in the entire ministry of this church worldwide? I can't keep him back just because, you know, he was my brother-in-law. And I feel that as a loyal man and a man that I can work with, and man with vast experience, in fact, telling you this is kind of interesting to me, and I thought about it, he is the only one who survived the administration of RCM, then the administration of Dave Annion, I mean under an executive position. He was a superintendent under me, a director under Dave Annion, a director or coordinator, whatever it became, under Wayne Cole, and a director or coordinator under Ron Dart, and a director or coordinator under Wayne Cole again, and now is still that under me, except I brought him to headquarters. So he will be the headquarters area coordinator now, because headquarters is such an important place, and of course he's already had that job for 10 days or so, but is still in the process of moving and all because of the conference. And again, if you can't get to one of us, Mr. McNair, though, Mr. Burke McNair, will also be a member of our nationwide and worldwide planning team, because I don't want to meet just with Benny and Luker and I, and we're going to solve things off in a corner. We will get Mr. Burke McNair, Raymond McNair, and these other men with us, Mr. Waterhouse, with their vast experience. And Mr. McNair graduated in 1954 and has been in the field ministry, you might say, ever since. So that's a long time. Longer than some of you have been alive, almost. I guess literally for some of you. So he does have a lot of experience, and I don't want to waste that experience. Then Mr. Will Berg is a man who, again, came to God's work years ago, had a college degree already from back east here somewhere, came to Ambassador College, graduated, I guess, in 56 or 7 or 8, somewhere in there, and has been in the ministry ever since. And a very faithful help a local elder for years and help in the letter answering department on various doctrinal teams, and yet always loyal to Mr. Armstrong, certainly a fine help in research and looking into things, and most recently has been a local elder full-time in the field, not way off, but living, not just from headquarters, but moved down literally and was living and working with Al Dennis in the Long Beach area with about 500 people down there as associate pastor and preaching sermons, visiting everybody, and handling the entire spectrum of the ministry. So Mr. Berg is going to be an administrative assistant to Mr. Luker and me, and again, he will be helping to correspond with a number of you on personal things for and with Mr. Luker and me, and helping plan things, organize things, and take phone calls, and all types of things of that sort, and we appreciate his help and his input. Mr. Ted Herlofson, now, over the ministerial services, has been loyal and faithful under all these administrations, as you know, and has been just a man whom I've always heard was not a politician. He didn't survive by politics. He just did his job. He just kept out of the way of the politics and did his job. And even though I was on the lower rung of the ladder or down below the ladder somewhere in the crack in the gutter, Mr. Herlofson was always courteous to me and to all of us in that way, was willing if I called him up, could we have lunch, because he knew I didn't know anything was going on and sort of liked to just visit with someone who knew what was happening on the other side of the tracks, because I'd literally been put across the freeway and was invited to no meeting about anything, even the time of day. So he said, well, yes, sir, and he would always have lunch with me just a day or two later, or that very day if he had time or whatever. And so Mr. Herlofson just continues in his post as the head of ministerial services, and we're very glad to have him on the team and his advice in every area as well. And then one who is has his own job also, Mr. Sherwin McMichael, remains over the feast, of course, operation. And but Mr. McMichael, again, has had vast experience in the field and been throughout many areas of the United States, and we're going to use his help and his advice as a counselor and occasionally make trips for us, as well as his feast trips feast planning trips, to the field, and that will help too. And then we are also going to have Mr. Herlofson, as I mentioned, and then Mr. Rod Matthews. Rod Matthews from Australia, who also spent 3 or 4 solid years in Brickett Wood, traveled to the continent many times, down to the dig in Jerusalem, and grew up overseas. He will be the overseas coordinator. And so from now on, as most of you men know, you'll be directing all your questions on all the questions of budget and just detailed things that have been done before, and I'll have to work with him and even learn what all those are, but he's been on the job a couple weeks already, to Mr. Matthews, and then he'll be bringing them to Mr. Luker and me, and we'll coordinate with you. And that doesn't mean, as I've explained to Mr. Wilson and Mr. McCullough and others, that doesn't mean he's over your areas at all. He's a coordinator of information, and he's very good at that. He worked under Mr. Luker, and now for a couple of years under Mr. Wilson in Australia, over church administration there at the headquarters of the Australian work, is very well fitted to that. He has an American wife, though, so we can sneak him into this country real quick, and we already are, and we're very grateful to have him and his experience on the team. Now, there may be one or two others added later. And, John Halford. Thank you, Denny. And I'll write his name down here, too, just for the future, at least to show I had it in my notes. But John Halford is cooperating and coordinating with Mr. Rod Matthews at this time, so he can replace him temporarily while Rod is moving all his home and family from Australia. Mr. Halford, as you know, is Australian. British. He'll shoot me for saying it. He's British, but went to Australia, was in the work there for years, and has worked so faithfully in Southeast Asia, and has a genuine compassion and empathy for all those people in various foreign parts of the earth, and has given some of the most inspirational sermons on those people and their situations of anyone. And I know he had my church in Los Angeles in tears of empathy. Not of sorrow, but of empathy, because of the compassion he showed for those people. So we're going to have him again as an advisor and an overseas advisor and staff assistant. And so he will not be the coordinator. Mr. Matthews will do that more ministerial services type, but Mr. Halford will help as he can and then make trips out and also advise us. And again, not be the boss over the top overseas men at all, but to be able to go out and even make special trips on his own, as he has, to Southeast Asia in coordination with Mr. Dean Wilson and his wishes and the other men in those far-flung areas. So that's the main team, and there may be one or two others added, but we hope to have a broad spectrum of advice and input into pastoral administration. Also, I have one other area here I want to cover, and that is the vital, and I really do mean vital, importance of the minister's wives. Mr. Armstrong has always said, and as I think he repeated again a couple days ago, that a minister's wife really should be half of his ministry. And it is a very, very important half. And all of you men who've been in the field for years should know that. Some don't because of the reorientation of the ministry and the watering down, frankly, of the whole concept of marriage and what wives are and all the rest of it that's come over us in the last few years. And I don't want to say this critically because some of this problem is not your problem. Some of it was what came from headquarters, I regret to say. And I'm sorry about that. I'm very sorry. I'm sure Jesus Christ is. But I hope we can get back to the right approach of deeply respecting and using the help and the input and the advice of our wives in these areas. It is very important for the wife to be involved in helping their husbands in the ministry. And often a wife, as you know, is not just a personal help in the sense of encouraging her husband and, of course, the cooking and the management of the household and backing him up, but directly counseling with wives that call in and that are troubled and just simply want to be encouraged. It may not be anything complicated or technical, but just need encouragement or simple answers about, you know, problems pertaining to women or problems even pertaining to the church, like we've had recently, and what's going on. And the husband may not be able to take time to talk to everyone at length. But if you have a wife that is truly dedicated and consecrated and trained and turned on, I mean loyally turned on to God and to Jesus Christ, and who's down on her knees for 30 or 40 minutes, lifting her hands to God each day in prayer and drinking in of her Bible as a Christian, a maidservant of Jesus Christ, God's Spirit is going to flow into her and out from her like rivers of living water also. And she can help those other ladies and occasionally other men as well. I remember visiting Burke and Billy McNair in the field and noticed Billy Sue manning the command post, as it sometimes was. And Burke was over anointing someone, and if I were on a visit and had lost sleep or in the travel change or something, and Burke were out anointing or something or other, well, here was Billy Sue in the kitchen. Oh, yes, Mrs. Jones, well, now this and that and so on, and here, just do this. And she was helping them and advising them and encouraging them and was a tremendous help to her husband. And we want to use that, and we want to even increase that. A woman can often counsel her husband, too. I don't mean just give him advice that he doesn't want, but the advice that he asks her for, and specifically be a counselor on the needs of the church from a different area, and not just the woman's point of view, but sometimes the point of view of the church as a whole. Because after all, we're all people. We're males and females, yes, but we all happen to be people. And, you know, as I can spot the problems of women, women can spot the problems of men and of the congregation as a whole. And that just gives you an extra bit of help, an extra set of eyes and ears, and a mind that's made in the image of God. And if the husbands use that mind and use that input, it's going to be a great help in their own counsel and in their planning for the future of the church. I think that I should at this time and would like to, and I hope it isn't you think that it's blowing anyone's horn, I just think I really should, because we may not see you fellows all together like this again for another year. And I'm sure we probably won't all in one place, and you wives. And I don't want her to come up necessarily or embarrass her, but I want to say that my wife, Cheryl, is one that, of course, I love very much and am very, very grateful to God for, because after my wife's death, I went through 6 months of the bleakest period since the day I was born. I'd been put down and kicked down over and over again from one job to another. And finally, my wife died and turned a kind of an ivory color right in my arms because of the things she'd had. And it just haunted me day and night. And I would just sit in my office sometimes and bawl. And but anyway, then I met Cheryl. And the first words, this may sound odd, but the first words she ever said to me were, "I love you." I'll explain that. She is a very vivacious person. And once you know her, as all the Bakersfield brethren do, all of them, because she is vivacious, you can understand it. Because she goes up and hugs people that she knows and is very friendly and affectionate and vivacious. But she came up, and I'd never met her before at all, but after a sermon that I gave in Bakersfield, which was one of my better sermons, and she said, thankfully, and She said, "I love you, Dr. Meredith. You helped me so much I just remembered the first three words." See? And all of my antennae begin to function, see? Says, "Well." So after she got through chatting with me about 5 or 7 minutes, and I even tried to prolong it and help her. Then later, after the service, I went over to Mr. Dan Orban, the pastor, and I said, "Well, who is this Cheryl Hensley? Who is she? You know, well, she told me she was a widow and all this and that." I thought, "Well, that's good. She's a widow, and I am a widower." And, you know, then there's no problems or complications. And if it has to be, you know, at least that was that way. So anyway, Mr. Orban said, "Well, she's really a zealous, you know, one of our most vivacious, and I think the most vivacious, I'll say, and one of our most zealous young women in the church." And he recommended her highly. So about 3 or 4 weeks later, I had to be back up there on official business. And I did have a lot of official business up there that summer. And I'm partly kidding, but mainly true. I'll tell you this. Mr. Steve Martin, as the area coordinator, had asked me, he really had, to help with the problem. And Mr. Orban, very graciously, was glad for me to, because 3 out of the 4 older deacons in that church had already left. 3 out of the 4 within the previous 2 years. And it wasn't Mr. Orban's fault. It had already been going on. I think 2 of them had already left before he got there. And I think the 4th one was in the process of leaving and did end up leaving. Even my help didn't save him. But then a newly ordained one did stay. But anyway, however it was, maybe I don't have the numbers right. Maybe it was 3 out of 5. And then the 4th one, who was newly ordained, stayed. And then later they ordained another one. Anyway, that's the way it was. And because of a deacon feud, it wasn't even doctrine. In that case, it was just jealousy among deacons. It was one of those awful things that sometimes come up. You know, who's important around here? And it really was a strange thing. But anyway, I was up there and helped out and tried to counsel them and talk to this Smokey Brown and try to save him, the one that was still hanging on, and he was having an awful time. And so I was working with those men, and some others were upset too, affected by them. And at least we did save a number of the borderline people. But also, I had the opportunity, once I'd, you know, taken care of their needs, to sort of say hello to this young widow up there. So God does command us to visit the widows. And I certainly wanted to do that, and I did. So I was up there, I guess, 6 or 8 times, and then finally I got her to coming down to Pasadena once we got even better acquainted, because I couldn't go up there. It wasn't right, and she would too much. So we were dating virtually every weekend from Friday evening until Sunday night. I'd get home about midnight or 1 o'clock from Bakersfield, and I put over 500 miles on my car every weekend and about a $15 or $20 phone bill through the week. But anyway, we had our long-distance courtship, and we were married about 5 or 6 months later. And so I'm very grateful for her. And she's been in the church since 1971, I think, or 2, it's 1, and had gone through a number of things, and has been a local church member, so was able to help me with things like that, which I appreciate. Mr. Raymond McNair's wife is also a newer wife in the ministry, but has been in God's church, I think, 12 or 15 years, something like that. And I think most of you know, and I want to say this here. I don't think Raymond and Evelyn were mine. They might be a little embarrassed, but Evelyn's wife had a husband that really mistreated her very much years ago. And this divorce was way back before our decision, and that was way, way back. But most of you who know the situation with Mr. McNair, and I just want to say it because, again, there have been some scurrilous, foul garbage, we could use a longer term, floating around to try to discredit him. But I personally know about it, not just from hearing him tell about it, but by being in his house during part of this time, and my 2 sons playing with their cousins, not playing with, but visiting with and staying over weekends with their cousins, Bruce and Joe, when his first wife had left the church and was virtually cursing him, cursing Mr. Armstrong with curse words, spitting literally in people's faces, and as hateful as a human being could be. And God does tell us, and the whole church of God decided long before this ever came up with Mr. McNair, back in 1 Corinthians 7:15, "But if the unbelieving depart, and I tell you before God in Christ, she sure departed." I mean, she departed so far that she is one of the major enemies of God's church in Southern California, and remains so to this day, and has been working actively and ferociously with the Ambassador Review. Tried to call me personally and get me to give them an interview here a year or so ago, which I would not do. And everyone else attends their meetings, attended Dr. Martin's meetings, fighting us and fighting us actively. "And if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. a brother or a sister is not under bondage, or as the Greek word is used here, luo, I believe it is, the same word that's used for bound. In other words, is not bound, is not luo in such cases. But God has called us to peace. And we've come to realize that what God has bound, He can unbind. That's part of our understanding on divorce and remarriage, which the whole church came to back in 1974. And so after about 2 solid years of living without a wife in a virtual hell on earth, Mr. McNair was encouraged by Mr. Armstrong and by Garner Ted Armstrong. And this is not a matter of a secret, because he told me that he'd done that with Raymond, and he told others, Ted Armstrong, that is, and Mr. Armstrong, both encouraged Raymond to put her away and divorce her, since she was just simply wanting to keep him on the string and get a free ride while she cursed him and would not have anything to do with him. There was not even a way of saying hello in a friendly way, living in opposite ends of the house in an armed truce or an armed hell. And the way to do was to put her away and do what 1 Corinthians 7:15 said, on the advice of the 2 top men in God's Word. And so he had done that after about a year and a half or whatever, and finally also, several months later, married his present wife. And he is not married to anyone else but his present wife, according to the understanding God's church came to back in 1974. Thank you very much. So I hope we can all understand that and not accept this garbage that's trying to be thrown at every leading man in God's church in one way or the other by Satan the devil through those whom he would use. So anyway, I hope we can understand that. Anyway, our wives can certainly help us and help you women, because they've been in the church, and they can help the women in the church, of course, that we're working with directly. And I want to say especially that some of the older wives, and I know our wives, I'm sure my wife won't be hurt by this at all, because I've talked to her briefly about it. I should have had longer, but we've hardly had time to say hello sometimes recently. But I know that Mrs. McNair, Billy Sue McNair, and Denny Luker's wife have both had the whole spectrum of Ambassador College and the field ministry for, in their respective areas, 15 and a half to about 25 and a half years experience. And a man, the command post, as I said, Billy Sue has, and certainly Lee Ann Luker has, and we do intend to use their input very heavily, these two ladies and others. I know Marion McCullough, Mr. Les McCullough's wife, has been faithful and helpful to him in the ministry and with the overseas wives, and Mrs. Luker and others have told me how helpful Mrs. McCullough has been to them. And I hope we can get her advice, because Mr. and Mrs. McCullough will be coming down regularly. And, of course, Mr. or Mrs. Dean Wilson, as they do get back. And we want to have ladies like that on our team and to help with advice for the field ministers' wives and certainly the ladies in the field, and give us advice about how we can help you to better serve. So that is a big area. And I don't want to condemn, and I'm not condemning anyone who has a job, any of the wives. Some wives have felt they had to because of inflation and other pressures. But the ideal thing, obviously, is for a wife to be a full-time wife to help her husband in God's ministry. And I hope that if we see in the future, as this thing straightens out, that the wives are able to be a help, and as the finances get caught up, that it is my intention to even give substantial bonuses where we see that that is the case to some of the men, because their wives are actually an extra set of arms and legs and eyes and ears and human mind that helps very much in God's ministry. And I think that that is something that ought to be recognized and ought to be honored and ought to be utilized, because it's such an important help. And we sure do appreciate it, and we want it to continue. Now, one other thing that we want to continue now in a different vein, but that is the YOU. Better look at our time here. The YOU. Mr. Jim Thornhill and I have had a meeting, and I'm very happy for him to continue in that area. And he's been loyal in spite of being one of Ted's closest friends, but realizes the problem and has chosen, as Mr. McCullough and Mr. Kelly have too, you know. Well, they can have friendship, but when someone rebels against God's government, they know where God's government is, and they've understood that. And he's going to continue there. But he himself came up without even a hint from me last Sabbath in Pasadena after services, and said that he felt, because of the obvious budgetary problems they were already having, that it would be better to curtail the national activities of the YOU for the next 6 months or so, and not to have this national basketball tournament, but to have all of your local tournaments and activities continue as you are able. And he will continue, and his staff there, to continue with ideas and coordination, but not to have the $40,000 to $60,000 expense for this national tournament. And I think you can all see the reason for that at this time, not spending that kind of money at this point. So that was his suggestion totally, which I agree with. And so we will cut back the national activities, but keep the team there. And then as soon as we're able, we'll get back to the national activities. And we certainly want that to continue. We also want, though, the ministry to have a far greater control and input into the YOU. There has been a problem there where the YOU guy would sometimes call and say, well, you do this and you do that. And some of our local ministers were working more for the YOU than they were for church administration and more for building up the church as a whole. And we don't want to get that out of hand, out of line. And we will try to balance that as time goes on, yet not hurting the YOU. We don't want that either. So we'll appreciate your ideas on that. The SEP, the Summer Educational Program, continues, however, God willing. And I think he will be willing. We certainly hope that will continue. That's such a wonderful thing for the young people. And we do need to continue to stress the vital importance of our youth and of their need to be helped and encouraged and worked with, and that they are the leaders of tomorrow and God's work. And I hope all of you men can go out and show a positive attitude. Just think, even some of us ministers, if we go back and show a negativeness about God's work, well, I don't know about this, and I don't know about that, and I don't know who to believe anymore. And our own sons hear us say that. What kind of effect do you think that has on a young teenage child that you hope in your own heart probably will someday be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ? And yet they've heard the parent go back with this kind of an attitude. So I hope we can all think of that for the brethren out there, the little sheep, and about the, about our own children as well, and be positive and really turned on for God's work. Well, I want Mr. Luker to make a few comments. I've already cut into his time some, but I'll just need about 10 minutes at the end, Denny. So you take about half an hour, 20 minutes.
That'll be fine. Thank you, Rod. Well, I'd like to start off by saying that I want everyone to understand that I do not feel important or exalted or someone special. I'm the same person that I was 10 years ago in the work, 15 years ago, or 20 years ago in the work. I am very thankful for the opportunity that God has given me, the job that he's given me. It's an awesome responsibility, and I intend to thank God for it every day, be loyal in this responsibility. I do not feel that I'm over any of the men who are senior to me in the work. I am not over them. My only authority comes from Mr. Meredith, from Mr. Herbert Armstrong, from Jesus Christ, through that line. And my intention is to be loyal and faithful and honest and truthful in supporting Mr. Herbert Armstrong and holding up his hands and remaining loyal in God's work. I just wanted to preface that statement because some of you might wonder why in the world is Dennis Luker sitting down here, I guess it is. Why am I doing what I'm doing? I wonder that same thing. I've never asked for a job in my life in God's church. I've never striven for a job or prayed for a job in God's work in my life. I've just left that up to God. But I have tried to serve God and obey God and be sincere and truthful in God's work. And that's what I intend to be doing. So I want all those who have been in the work in so many areas and all the other evangelists, I want you to know how I feel in my heart. And my desire is to assist and to serve and not be over, rule over in any way like that, but to help Rod Meredith and Mr. Herbert Armstrong and Jesus Christ. Rod and I are friends. He made a few comments. He does embarrass me when he talks that way about me. When you're sitting here and someone is saying those things, it is a little bit embarrassing. But I have been in the work of God for 20 years and in the ministry 15 and a half years and overseas 4.5 years. And God has given me some fantastic blessings. And I could never get bitter because God has blessed me too much and given me too many blessings in his work. I've got quite a few notes here, so I'll have to hurry, Rod. He did mention that in Phoenix, where I was for 1.5 years before coming into headquarters, that I doubled the size of the church. That isn't true. We actually had one large church when I arrived there, and we made 2 churches out of it. So, but we did start, that sounds like it's doubling, but it didn't. We did start, though, a new church up in Prescott, Arizona, and a new church in Flagstaff, Arizona, which you might all remember because a lot of members are moving to Arizona because of the weather and other reasons. And you might let them know, if they need to know, that we do have a church in Prescott and in Flagstaff. And here I would like to acknowledge two men who have been a great help to me in my last assignment in Phoenix, and that is Mr. Camilo Reyes, who is the associate pastor there, again, a fantastically loyal individual, as many of you here are, but he was a great help to me and will continue to be so, I'm sure. And then Mr. John Amos, who lives up in Prescott. Mr. Amos is not a graduate of the college, but worked at headquarters for 3 years under Mr. Norman Smith. And he is an elder in the church, full-time employed, and again, is an extremely loyal person. I want you all to know that, and where they stand, how loyal they are, and who they're supporting and backing. Extremely loyal men, and I have to acknowledge their help. Now, Mr. Mark Cardona is the one replacing me in Phoenix. Everyone wanted Phoenix. It is a choice assignment. It's a fantastic assignment. I picked Mr. Cardona. Mr. Meredith approved it because I knew Mr. Cardona very well. He has returned from Australia for 5 years, and I know that he is totally loyal, and that's what we're looking for, people who are totally loyal to help stabilize the churches. And being in Phoenix gave me an unusual opportunity that I never, ever dreamed that I would have, never planned or plotted it in any way whatsoever, but that was to get to know Mr. Herbert Armstrong better, much better than I had ever known him before. And because Phoenix is only a couple of hours up north, I did have the opportunity to visit Mr. Armstrong, and I visited in his home with him on 6 different occasions in this last year. And each time you visit with Mr. Armstrong, it usually runs into anywhere from 2 to 4 hours, because Mr. Armstrong is a very friendly person and is willing to talk and be open. If he knows you and if he knows where you stand, he does seek advice from those that he knows are loyal. So God gave me that opportunity to talk with him for hours about the work and how he feels. I wanted to know how Mr. Herbert Armstrong felt, because I had heard coming back from Australia, well, Mr. Armstrong has changed his feelings on some of these things, and he's approved that change and that change, and it's different now. But I found out from the boss's mouth that it isn't, that he is the same man with the same approach, the same attitude, the same character, only more, I feel, the same feeling about God's work, God's church, about doctrine that he was before I went to Australia and was gone 4.5 years. He had not changed, except for the things that we all know that he has approved and changed. And so many of us had been fed a line that Mr. Armstrong had changed this and approved this and had a different approach now in the work. You've all seen that during the conference. He hasn't. He's the same man. I had just about 3 points before something that I feel is important that I want to say to you. But some have handed 2 or 3 questions in that I would give a real brief comment on. Some have asked, what will be the effects of the receivership on our salary checks, hall rental checks, widow's checks, and various other checks? Well, we hope nothing, but if they have bounced, one of my checks bounced, some of the widow's checks bounced, I called the accounting office, talked to Gerald Seelig, and he said, just have those checks redeposited, and they have worked it out with the bank. All those checks will be acknowledged and run through until the funds dry up, I don't know, in Pasadena, whatever, if that happens. Maybe I shouldn't have said that, but the mail is coming into Tucson, and I know God is going to work things out, so I would say, don't worry about it, trust God, and things will work out. But if any check bounces, redeposit it at the bank. I did that when my salary check, and it did go through, and the widow's check did go through. If there's any other problem, call Gerald Seelig in the accounting office. And real quickly, all transfers or moves that were underway should continue. There was some question about some of the changes that were taking place here at this time, but they will go ahead. Some are saying, well, maybe we shouldn't continue with our transfer because of a shortage of funds. Check with Mr. Herlofson. And if there's no money to pay for the move, fine, but we do want those moves to continue. Then one other announcement quickly. Some have read in the newspapers about our Swiss bank accounts and gold bullion, especially those who have been a little bit negative about the work and the church and feel that we are all hiding things. That comes across very bad. Well, this came out in Pasadena last week. And talking with some of our ministers overseas, Mr. John Carlson came up to me, and he said, well, yes, he says, that's true. We do have Swiss bank accounts and gold. We have a Swiss bank account, he said. The German Swiss brethren send their tithes and offerings to a bank account in Zurich. We do have Swiss bank accounts, definitely. I don't know of any hidden, personal, secret Swiss bank accounts. I have no knowledge of them myself. But the work does have Swiss bank accounts for the convenience of the brethren and their tithes and offerings. Also, Mr. Carlson mentioned that in the bond office, Mr. Frank Schnee years ago, as we have done in Pasadena, invested some of the work's funds in gold. I mean, I wish I could do that. They did that years ago. And that's a great investment to have, as you all know. So we do have gold in banks, in the work. What's wrong with that? See, it's always implied there's something evil about it. But that would be a tremendously wise thing. Dennis Stauffer did it for the work here as a good investment in Pasadena. Mr. Schnee did it in Germany in the work there so that they have some Kruger Rand coins in over there, because he mentioned that the work must have collateral in order to borrow money. They've got to have something like that that is real collateral. So there is some truth to that, but don't believe the evil, malicious rumors that are going around. Others worried about some of the fellows about this sheet that was sent out to all of you from someone showing that if the church was ever dissolved, all of our assets would go so-and-so different places, and about this little voting clause on the bottom of the sheet. Well, Mr. Armstrong has appointed a new board, and they would be the ones to determine the future of the work, as he explained. You don't have to worry about that anymore. And the voting thing was nothing more than a legal technicality required on a legal document. And Mr. Armstrong took care of fulfilling that in a conference, I believe it was, at a group of the headquarters churches and ministers, where he said, well, do we all agree? You know, we don't really believe in voting, but let's go ahead. Do you all agree that we should do such and such? You know, and everybody, of course, agreed with Mr. Armstrong, and I think sincerely so. I really mean that. And so he fulfilled the letter of the law on that requirement, and yet that's been a real picky thing in some people's minds, immediately questioning Mr. Armstrong's integrity. So I thought I would pass that on. I'd like to close here, leaving Mr. Meredith a few minutes at the end, by reading a letter that I just received here at the conference. I think will cause a lot of you to think about your ministry and about your churches and about the job that you have and what we hope you can go back to and do a better job. This is a letter from a member who's been in God's church for at least 20 years, a very loyal member to the church, very loyal to Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong. And this was passed on to me by someone who delivered it personally to me. And this loyal member said, please ask Mr. Luker if he could send a minister to our area that is strong and stable, and a minister who would let us know where he stands. Many people in the area are confused, and we've heard that GTA is coming here soon to meet with those, quote, having questions, unquote. If it hadn't been for the strength of the other minister, and I'm leaving names out, but they're here, we just don't know what might have happened to the churches here in the area. We have not had strong leadership here since 1972. That's her words. Many people here don't think our minister will even return after the conference. But if he does, he has already lost the trust and the respect of many in this area. It doesn't matter who we have here. Just someone that is loyal and strong for the tough times ahead. I won't read the rest of it. I think that's enough of it there. But what kind of minister are you? What kind of minister have you been? I'll put it that way. Before this conference and before you came here, what kind of minister were you? Do those words fit you as a minister who is out there believing hook, line, and sinker, in many cases, the grapevine of rumors that was being fed purposely and intentionally to the field ministry for the purpose of undermining your faith and your confidence in Mr. Armstrong and in this church? Now, how far...